You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, good morning, everyone. My name is Beth Ferris. I'm a senior fellow at Brookings and co-director of the Brookings Barron Project on Internal Displacement. And we're delighted to welcome you to this session on human rights, democracy, and displacement in Georgia. You know, since our little project began in 1994, we've had a particular interest in Georgia in terms of the long-standing displacement situation of many people from several different times of conflict, and we'll be hearing more about that this morning. But we put together a panel today to look at various aspects of current developments in Georgia. Georgia, of course, a very important strategic ally of the United States, one with the constitutional processes underway, and we'll hear more about the status of democracy and some of the issues around that this morning. We have a panel of four people. We'll begin by hearing from colleagues from Georgia with Tinatin Kidashelli, who is the co-author of this report that I hope that you all received this morning and is a member of the Tbilisi City Council and the Republican Party, formerly with the Young Lawyers Association of Georgia. We'll then hear from Georgi Chadsta. Is that right, Chadsta? Okay, well, that was close enough, I think, and who is a former chair of the Georgia Young Lawyers Association and a human rights lawyer. And they'll be speaking about human rights, particularly in the last couple of years in Georgia after the war with Russia. We'll then turn to Sam Patton, who is a senior program manager for Eurasia and has worked a lot on Georgia, as you've seen from his bio, and just back from Georgia, actually, and we'll talk about some of his developments. And then we'll hear from Nadine Wolicki, who is from the Norwegian Refugee Council based in Geneva, actually Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, where she's been following issues around Georgian displacement for at least the last 4 years. So it looks like a good panel, and we'll begin with over here and then have some comments, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So, Tina.
Should I go?
Yes.
Do I need to? Oh, okay. Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much, first of all, for being here and being interested in Georgia affairs. I'm Tinatin Kidashelli, as it was said here. I represent Republican Party today, but I used to work for human rights NGOs for 15 years. I'm one of the founders of the Georgian Young Lawyers Association and the former chairman, as well as Georgi was. We have put together this report already starting from 15th of August 2008. As soon as war was over, there were groups of human rights organizations in Georgia who went to the field, meeting with the IDPs in camps, collecting information, because there was an understanding that there was still lots of evidence available and we needed to be quick to have all the evidences collected as much as possible to prove later on whatever violations those evidences would have led us to. And all this work was possible due to generous support from the Open Society Georgia Foundation, which was there ready for all the groups interested in dealing with the IDP situation at that time and consequences of the August war. We have managed to collect around 2,000 interviews and around 6,000 different kinds of evidences, being photos, videos taken by and brought from their villages by the Georgian IDPs, proving the interference by the Russian troops, proving the ethnic cleansing, lots of different human rights violations in the conflict area. And the conclusion of the report, once we've collected all those documents and interviews, was that, and this is what we are trying to prove here in this paper, is that there was an ethnic cleansing conducted in Georgia, very massive, well-planned, organized ethnic cleansing. People were forced out of the region due to their nationality with the idea that they will never go back. We have collected lots of interviews from those days by both Russian and South Ossetian authorities, where they very clearly say what their intentions are. They are even proud of saying what their intentions are, that they will not allow any Georgian to go back. We've collected interviews from the elderly who stayed in the villages till the very last moment when it was still possible, who've been told that they should leave, not because they constitute any threat to the independent state of South Ossetia, but because if they are there, it means that the youngsters will come back to look after their grandparents. So that was the reason why those people were also forced to leave from those places. And we strongly believe that regardless of the size of the nation, regardless of the importance of the nation, if there is an international crime committed, people should be held accountable. Again, not depending on the how important is this power or how strong is this power. We've presented reports last year to the ICC. Georgi and myself, we were in The Hague, meeting with the prosecutor, talking for 2.5 hours, trying to convince him to start the case on the August war. There were a couple of visits from ICC to Tbilisi and Moscow, and we are still waiting for their final decision. And we are very optimistic and hopeful that there will be a case actually on the ethnic cleansing on the territory of Georgia. We feel it's very important to bring the justice to this region, not only because of the August war, but because of everything what happened for the last 20 years in the region, in the South Caucasus. If the people are not held accountable at one point, it's like a vicious circle and it's never going to end. There will be always a war, there will be always hostility, there will be something similar to August war happening all the time. We've been witnessing it over and over again for this last 20 years, and I'm absolutely confident that it's going to happen again, whether in Georgia or Azerbaijan or Armenia, Chechnya, anywhere, it's going to happen as long as people feel that they are not accountable. No one is going to be punished, and it goes easy because there are some superpowers involved who cannot be brought to justice. This is not to say that it's only one side to be held accountable, obviously, and our report clearly shows although it's kind of one-sided because we were not allowed in South Ossetia and we were not allowed to do our research in the villages that are not under Georgian control, but we had a strong assistance and support from some Russian human rights groups who've been providing us with the information from the other side. And whatever we managed to collect, we've put it in the report, and we've tried to be as objective as possible to bring the clear picture of the entire developments during those 5 days, as you say, but 3 days in reality that the war was going on in South Ossetia. There are a number of international crimes one can think of and talk about and investigate on, but again, we are waiting for the response from the ICC, and if they will be interested, I'm pretty sure that there will be some justice brought to the region not only for the August war, but for all the wars that happened in Georgia for all those years. Where are we today after 2 years from the August war? I think that it was used as a nice excuse by everybody, including my own government. August war was seen as an opportunity for the politicians to use the consequences of it in their own interest. And after August war, we've got the whole campaign of blaming of Russian spies and searching for the agents every week, KGB agents every year, and again seeing it as an opportunity for the oppression of the political opposition and for starting various campaigns against the people who dare to raise their voice. There was one case I will tell you to have an idea how it was used by the government. Georgian Young Lawyers Association has brought around how many cases, Georgi? 150 cases to Strasbourg Court of Human Rights. And 149 of them were against Russia. And only one case was against Georgia. It's a case of disappearance of some Ossetian nationals after the war. And actually, there was a response from the Georgian Ministry of Justice, which is the prosecutor's office at the same time, that they were not arrested, but they were held in a private apartment for security reasons, although no one has seen them before that. And there was a case to Strasbourg. There was an interim decision, and then these people were released and sent back to South Ossetia after the decision from the Strasbourg court. But why am I saying this story is that there was a whole campaign against the Georgian Young Lawyers Association because of that case. All national media for 3 days was doing nothing but saying how this organization serves Russian interests and how naive they are when the human rights are more important to them than the national interests, and how much they don't understand what the Russian media or Russian authorities will get out of this case. This is kind of an atmosphere we are in. If anyone dares to raise a question, to raise a doubt about the Georgian part on August conflict, then immediately there is a Gazprom label for you. Anytime, any moment, and the national Georgian state-controlled national media will be happy to broadcast and to talk about it for days. But obviously, it does not prevent anyone from having their independent opinions and talking about the realities of the war and after-war situation. Me personally and the Republican Party, we had a press conference on 8th of August, different from every single other opposition party in Georgia who have announced kind of a moratorium on the when the war started. They've said that it's no time for criticizing the government, for the opposition. Now we shall all stand united and fight against Russia. On 8th of August, the Republican Party was the only political group which made a statement, and we've said that happened what should not have happened, and we've addressed to the international community to stop Georgian government and to do everything possible for having this war as short as painless as possible, and less damage and less human lives taken due to the war. And our assessment was and still is that it was a trap, but it was a trap where Misha Saakashvili walked in voluntarily, and which he has used for his very personal power, keeping in power reasons. Just a short reminder, where we were in August 2008, politically speaking and as a state. We had two elections which we strongly believe were falsified. I don't think anybody doubts anymore the falsification of the presidential elections on 5th of January 2008. There was a very strong report by the OSCE about the parliamentary elections as well, issued after the war, unfortunately, end of August. But still, it is there, and it speaks about every single problem that country faced. Saakashvili was not a hero, national hero anymore, not this great guy whom people prayed for, and he needed something that would have bring the confidence to him and that would have unified the nation around him. And this is when the August War happened. And this is when he felt that there was an opportunity for him. And it actually kept him in power. It actually helped to have the nation unified. It helped to have him back to the streets on 12th of August demonstrating and celebrating I don't know what. And the Georgia national media was broadcasting the results of the war as if we won the war. There was a not very nice joke after the war and after what the Georgian media was broadcasting, said that if Hitler had Rustavi 2, which is one of our private channels, German people would have still believed that they won the Second World War. That was kind of a situation we were in August, September, October of 2008. If you were living somewhere in a remote Georgian village where you have only two national TV channels and nothing more, then you would have easily believed that Georgia actually won the war against 80,000 soldiers who came to Georgia and some 1,500 planes that flew the Georgian territory. These are the figures given by our president, and 800 tanks that entered the Georgian territory. It was like the entire Russian army was in Georgia, according to the speeches we were hearing every day. And on 12th of August, there was a huge celebration in Georgia, celebrating again, I don't know what. And this is the moment when Georgian hostages were still in Tsinwali, and in the report we have a couple of interviews where they say that they were tortured and the TV was on and the perpetrators were telling them that, look, your country does not care about you. They are celebrating, singing, dancing on the streets while we are torturing here, and why don't you just change sides and agree to the to getting the Russian passports and giving the whatever evidences they were statements they were requiring from them to give. And after that, lots of people were still killed while being hostages, and all those horrible things were still happening. But the show was on, and he was the hero. And that was the whole idea. And so today, Georgia faces lots of different challenges in security terms, democracy-wise, constitutional reform, which was just mentioned, lots of doubts, lots of questions, what are real plans. 2013 is going to come, which is the year of the presidential elections, regardless of developments in a country, calendar is not going to stop. And obviously, it's a huge pressure over Saakashvili, and I am absolutely sure that he has no final decision yet what he's going to do. So constitutionally, he prepared grounds, but I'm, again, almost sure that there is no final decision yet, neither who is going to be next leader of the current ruling party, nor what Saakashvili is going to do in 3 years' time, and anything might happen. We can talk from very dramatic developments, which might be starting another war, announcing state of emergency and keeping him in power forever, which is not going to happen, but like the extreme, most extreme possibility, finishing with a peaceful transfer of power and other political forces coming to power, which again is not going to happen. But there are lots of different variations in between the two, and anything is possible. It depends a lot on the position of the international community, how much responsibility our partners and friends in the West will take about Georgia, about the assistance they deliver to Georgia, about all the support for all these 20 years, how much they value the support that they deliver to Georgia for these 20 years, how much they care about real democracy, state building in the country. And of course, a lot depends on the Georgian people as well, who are the ones who should take the final decision at the end of the day. But again, having the 2008 January elections experience, unfortunately, we say that decision of the Georgian people sometimes is not enough. There are some others who might think that they are the ones in charge and they can take decision. This is what happened on 5th of January with the statement we had in the morning by the U.S. Congressman, Mr. Hastings, who has declared that 5th January elections were a triumphant step to democracy, and that was it. End of the story. No counting, no results were there, but he still declared it. And we've got Misha as the president. No second round, no developments. I need to finish here because other people need to speak. I'll be happy to answer any questions, whether it's about the war or state of democracy or constitutional reform in Georgia. Thank you very much again for being here, and I forward the floor to Georgi.
Yes. Thank you very much, Tina Tain. Certainly. Georgi.
Thank you. Thank you very much for Brookings Institution for organizing this event. Thank you for coming. I myself will be short and actually provide the perspective from the NGO human rights approach, which was an issue while I was a chairman of the Georgian Young Lawyers Association during August war or afterwards. Tinatin provided to you specific, let's say, goals as well as process how this report was created. Let me add specific principles around which a number of non-government organizations assembled, because beyond Georgian Young Lawyers Associations, four more, at least at the national level as well as at the local level, non-governmental watchdog organizations been working to collect all this information, to visit victims, witnesses all around the country, displacement camps, so-called buffer zones, villages, etc. There were a number of principles. First of all, our work, we are guided by the principle of the human rights approach. We had approached to collect information and analyze information from the human rights perspective, less from the academic perspective, and of course less from the party political perspective. Our objective was to have information collected and preserved for the future mechanisms, whether it's international criminal court or national investigation, to follow up on that and to investigate and punish perpetrators, but not for the punishment of sake of punishment, but for the sake of the remedy to the victims and for the sake of the justice delivered as a result of the human rights violations. So beyond the human rights approach, we had individual approach. Although the report is based on a number of public documents, reports, analysis, maps, assessments, etc., which are available at the internet or publicly, we wanted to have personal stories here. We wanted to follow personal stories of the families, victims, hostages, civilian hostages, or military hostages, and to have this story and specific information provided by the individuals checked and analyzed based on the public documents and public information to detect more or less reliable information and present to you for further consideration. We had, as Tinati mentioned, non-discriminative approach. So for us, it was important to see any violation of human rights, basic principles of international humanitarian law happened as a result during or afterwards of the war, whether it was happening towards the Georgian ethnic Georgians, against ethnic Georgians, or against other ethnicities. And the objective obstacle, which is still around for the Georgian NGOs to travel in occupied territories, is something which we could not overcome, of course, although we cooperated with Russian Human Rights Watchdog, like Memorial and others, to provide us information, but it's different. Possibility, of course, cannot ensure full access to information. For us, it was important to have, objective to provide this information to government, because we believed and still believe that it's a primary responsibility of the Georgian government to investigate all human rights violations happened during the war or afterwards. Investigation being launched, and we hope that it will reach positive results for the victims, because the one question which was asked from the prosecutor of the ICC, what is the expectation of the people who gave us information? And I can tell from our experience that we continued to, provide some services. Young Lawyers Association continued providing services to the victims of the war, and they've been always and still are asking whether there might be possibility for international investigation or any kind of investigation to provide the remedy, which is definitely the remedy for seeing someone held responsible for the actions as well as for the damages caused by the material or other damages caused by as a result of this action. For us, it was really important to provide this information to you in a clear way. So the work which was done by Tinatin as well as by international expert in international criminal law, it was quite challenging to collect all this information and to make it as user-friendly as possible. But we believe that we achieved something. And together with this paper copy, some of you had the possibility to collect CDs where you can find, in addition to the report, video, audio, and other materials, photos, of course. And it was huge, challenge to collect all these materials and to check their source of information, as well as to provide a specific, linkage to the report. What's happening afterwards when it comes to the victims, when it comes to the internal displacement, citizens, that might be more appropriate from my side to follow up on this. Of course, we have a set of issues related to the IDPs, and my colleagues, I believe, will address this. But let me say the following. There have been a number of cases sent to the European Court of Human Rights, not only by Georgian Young Lawyers Association, but also by other organizations. And we hope that European Court of Human Rights, which is really important for Georgian legal system, will provide effective, follow-up on these cases. It's really important to say that NGO community, and all the activists of GAILA and other organizations who've been working on this report, continue to work jointly and created Georgian Coalition for International Criminal Court, and this coalition cooperates with the international coalition. And the objective of the of NGOs right now is to follow up on this report and to ensure if there were some additional violations, unfortunately, after August events related to the war, to detect that, to follow up on that, as well as to see and to seek effective follow-up from the side of the ICC, calling for the investigation as well as for this from the side of the national government. In addition to the activities when it comes to the International Criminal Court, Georgian non-governmental organizations right now work in the area of providing legal assistance to IDPs, other important assistance for the social protection, for the pushing more participatory, let's say, democracy for IDPs to for IDPs to be able to participate in the decision-making process, as well as Georgian NGO community assembled together with the support from the Open Society Georgian Foundation by creating a mechanism, coalition for the monitoring of the international aid coming to Georgia after war. We put some brochures about this coalition, but we will provide you some additional information if you are interested in. The coalition works in the area of anti-corruption monitoring, transparency, as well as accountability to ensure that this aid which has been and still is coming to Georgia to be effectively spent and for the public, Georgian public, especially to know results of this support. And finally, I would like to mention that it's really important for justice, for Georgian democracy, for well-being of the state, your support, your advice, as well as your involvement. But it's really more important for local citizens and victims of this war to feel that they are not forgotten. And we are trying our best, Georgian lawyers, non-government organizations, some of the other institutions. However, this is an area which is not sometimes isolated within Georgia. This is an area where there should be cross-country cooperation and international approach. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Georgi. Nice to hear. We'll turn now to Sam Patton from Freedom House.
Thanks, Beth. It's a pleasure to be here today on behalf of Freedom House. I think Nadine will talk a little bit about the IDP situation. I'd like to briefly address the report itself and why documents like this are very important in terms of adjudicating the aftermath of an event like the Georgian War, and also just some general observations on the political situation in Georgia as I've seen it in the last couple of years. I'd like to commend the authors of this report, Gila and the other authors. It's a compelling read, and it really does provide as close as one can get to a clear-eyed perspective on what is a very polarized and very painful situation in the aftermath of the Georgian War. Just to look at it in a little bit of context, I've been spending some time recently in Kyrgyzstan, where there's also been ethnic cleansing. And the difficulty of getting a society to speak honestly about such issues is a huge challenge and critical to restorative justice and the hopes for finding some resolution. And this report just is very, very important in terms of putting facts on the table that can be discussed and, as we've heard today, can be brought before courts. I think there are actions before the ICC and also the European Court of Human Rights, and it will be important as these legal processes go forward to see how the report and its findings can help people better understand how to prevent this kind of naked aggression in the future. The role of the youth in documenting human rights abuses is, I think, very important and obviously played a big role in this report. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of volunteers who were brought together to quickly assess information in Gori, in Shidakartli, and throughout the area that they were able to access. It's important, I think, to look at the disproportionality of such a well-documented report as this, and the lack of documentation we see on the other side. Thanks to Human Rights Watch and some brave work by Tatiana Lokshina and others, we were able to look at the Russian government's claims about its intentions and its actions during the war and in the aftermath of the war, and get some sense of perspective. However, we don't see this type of detailed reporting on the Russian side, and it would be very helpful if one were able to, if the international community could get that kind of sort of fact collection from both sides. Another thing that's interesting about this report in terms of human rights documentation is the use of satellite imagery, which I think was really advanced during the 2008 war, beyond what had been used before in terms of publicly available UNISAT satellite imagery, so that the ethnic cleansing that occurred could clearly be seen. Destroyed villages, destroyed houses could be seen by satellite imagery. During that time, I was working in the State Department, and close monitoring was happening via satellite. One felt sort of helpless to see a friend of the United States, like Georgia, suffer from the Russian aggression that was happening at that time. However, one was able to get a clearer picture of what was going on, thanks to the kind of documentation that technology affords. So this report is a good showcase of that. It also talks a little bit about the difference between the physical and the moral damage that Georgia suffered during the war. And I've had the ability to travel to Georgia a couple times since the war, once in early 2009, once in early 2010, and again just last week. And I was pleased just anecdotally to be able to see a change in the national spirit. Clearly, the country was demoralized in the aftermath of the war. It was certainly not a victory for Georgia. It was a defeat, and it was a time of great national suffering and shame. And to be invaded by another country is never a pleasant thing. The impression that I got in my most recent visit is that the Georgian national spirit is more revived now than it was 2 years ago. Certainly. That as a result of having been able to have a dialogue about what happened during the war, arguably, as Tina mentioned, there is polarization in the Georgian media. So, one can question the degree to which that is a fully objective dialogue. However, it is a dialogue. And it's not the same dialogue that I've seen in Kyrgyzstan, where it's considered unpatriotic entirely to talk about ethnic cleansing that happened in the south of Kyrgyzstan in June of this year. So there's a qualitative difference there in terms of just the ability to discuss things. However, clearly there can be more advances made in terms of media freedom in Georgia. There's sort of a difference between the legal cases and sort of the court of international public opinion in terms of how this war has been viewed. Georgia seems to me to be unique in that it's one of the few countries. We've just come out of an election in the United States in which foreign policy was not an issue. It was a very distant concern in most American polls. It was a fifth, sixth, seventh ranked concern. It was rarely brought up on the stump. In Georgia, foreign policy is always a primary concern. First or second concern, because the hope for reintegration with South Ossetia and Abkhazia is a central hope to the Georgian people and their aspirations. And the role of foreign policy is critical in that respect. The Georgians want to know more about where Caucasus policy falls in U.S. foreign policy. They watch the actions of large countries like the United States and Russia with existential concern. And I think that's an important thing to remember when looking at Georgia. I had the chance to meet a Russian in Tbilisi last week who moved to Georgia before the war. He was a human rights defender and a media freedom advocate. And he chose to move to Georgia before the war and indicated that the war showed for him, more than anything else, the clear difference between Russia and Georgia, in that he said, my country does not understand freedom. And as a result of the war and having lived through this war, I can see more clearly now than I have before that there is a very clear line in terms of respect for freedom. And it was an attempt to destroy Georgia's freedom, essentially, that led to the war, among many other circumstances. So, I'd be happy to talk generally about Freedom House methodology and our reports in the question and answer period. But with that, I think Nadine would.
Thank you very much, Sam. And now we'll hear about internal displacement from Nadine.
thanks for organizing this event and inviting me here. My focus will be on internal displacement as a result of the 2008 conflict. I'd also like to commend the authors of the report. It does provide a wealth of information on the human rights violations caused by the conflict and that happened during and even after the conflict. I wanted to highlight just a few of human rights issues that seem to be a bit background or secondary in the report, and then go on to talk about some of the other issues still facing IDPs displaced in 2008 today. The report very clearly talks about violations of the right to life and the right to liberty and security of the person. Examples such as deprivation of life, arbitrary arrest, detention, and so on. Most interviews, as mentioned, are with IDPs, and one kind of underlying theme is that the violations that were happening actually led to forced displacement of these people. And there's two issues here that I wanted to highlight. The first is loss of property, possessions, housing, land. In the report, there's a lot of information about deliberate acts of destruction, burning, pillage, and other reports document these instances as well. In addition, bombing and shelling of populated areas caused people to lose property, including livestock, access to land, and so on. Many of these people who suffered this destruction were displaced, have lost their livestock, vehicles, property, and so on. And there's little immediate prospect of regaining what they have lost. So the right to protection against arbitrary deprivation of their property is definitely an issue that led to their displacement. The second issue that led to their displacement was, as mentioned earlier, the ethnic cleansing of ethnic Georgians, and this was also concluded by the International Fact-Finding Mission, that ethnic cleansing was practiced against ethnic Georgians in South Ossetia, both during and after the conflict. Ethnic Georgian homes were systematically looted and torched, and I was surprised by the one percentage in the report that 72% of respondents had their homes destructed or burnt. This ethnic cleansing led to their forced displacement, and forced displacement for the purpose of ethnic cleansing is arbitrary, and as a result, the protection against arbitrary displacement wasn't there. So these two issues, loss of property and ethnic cleansing, led to the forced displacement of people. How are these people living now, people that have been internally displaced as a result of the conflict? Those living on the territory of Georgia proper under the effective control of the Georgian government, we wanted to highlight four issues they face today. These aren't the only issues, but these are considered some of the more pressing ones. The first being freedom of movement. Return as of yet is not possible. The South Ossetian authorities are largely not allowing return. Others who were displaced within Georgia proper had been pressured to return, and most have, but this return we're seeing is unsustainable, at least for the time being, as a result of continued insecurity and loss of access to land and livelihoods. Another issue related to freedom of movement is crossing the so-called administrative boundary line. It's reportedly difficult to cross both ways from Shidakartli and back. However, some people still manage to cross, either unintentionally or to visit relatives, graveyards, markets, and so on. However, the result has been the division of families and communities, and again, a disruption of livelihoods. The second issue, which has already been mentioned as well, is access of IDPs to justice and reparations for the violations they've suffered. Thus far, there's been a lack of effective judicial recourse, and it seems international aspects of the conflict and the de facto physical division of the areas have complicated the problem of access to justice for these people. And of course, as Tina Tin said, there's a need to bring the perpetrators to account on all sides. The third issue still facing IDPs today is access to livelihoods. As I've mentioned, access to land is difficult or impossible, and livelihoods very much were agriculturally based, so as a result, people have been cut off from their access to their livelihoods. But also livestock was looted and other assets for livelihoods as well. And this affects the long-term ability of people to support themselves and gain an adequate standard of living again. IDPs have been given land on the territory of Georgia proper. However, this land has not always been in sufficient quantity or quality and has not allowed all of these IDPs to secure food for their family. The fourth issue, and not necessarily the last, is adequate housing. IDPs were housed in newly built cottages. Others chose to receive compensation instead. However, those who opted for compensation, 2 years later, many are still waiting to receive this money and live in dire conditions. The Public Defender's report that was presented this week explains more about this. Those who chose to settle in new cottages, these cottages were built very quickly, but the quality often suffered, and some construction flaws are being addressed, but largely there's still several issues with this housing, including mold, leaking roofs, warped floorboards, vermin, and so on. Finally, I'd just like to mention that in addition to IDPs displaced in 2008, there were also people displaced in the 1990s from Abkhazia and South Ossetia to the territory of Georgia proper. They still also face these issues some 20 years later. So it would be important to not again revisit these issues as a result of unfinished business now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nadine. Thanks to all of our panelists. We have time now for questions. If you could identify yourself, and there should be a microphone coming. This is the first time at a Brookings event I haven't seen a lot of hands go up. Yes, please.
Hi, Christina Jeffers with the National Democratic Institute. I was wondering if I could direct a question to Ms. Giudicelli about the Electoral Code Working Group. You spoke about the 2008 elections and disappointment with the process and the conduct. Your party is participating in the Inter-Party Working Group on Reform of the Electoral Code for the upcoming 2012 parliamentary elections. I was wondering if you could tell us where that process stands, and what your party's expectation is for consensus on improvements to the Electoral Code or changes to the Electoral Code.
Thank you very much. Republican Party is the party which advocates for the elections every time. So we have participated in every election in Georgia since the independence, and we are not planning to boycott any in the future. There was an eight-party working group set up after the local elections in April 2010, and the idea was to draft the legislation to address the main concerns from the last three elections. The group has prepared quite a substantial document. It covers all the areas, starting from the electoral code, going through the independent media or giving independence to media, and police non-interference from the police in the electoral processes, which are three main problems Georgia faces right now in terms of the elections. And it was presented to the ruling party in September. We've been waiting for their response for a long time. As far as I know, last week, I'm out of Georgia for 3 weeks now, but what I was told last week, there was a first meeting of the ruling party and those eight parties. And in terms of the progress and my expectations, well, it's very difficult to say, and it will be a speculation what I say now, but coming from the previous experience we have had with the ruling party, with the involvement of NDI, for example, when the local elections, before the local elections, there was a working group. We had a full cooperation from the national movement till the very last moment, full cooperation. In terms of the legislation, in terms of the states to, steps to be taken, setting up an interagency working group, which was meant to monitor the police activities during the electoral process, which was meant to monitor the media balance for the elections. But at the very last moment, before the draft law was sent to the parliament, we've got the change in the conditions of the consensus. So the whole idea in Georgia today, and it's very easy to understand, is that national movement holds constitutional majority in parliament. They don't need involvement of any political party to pass the laws to bring any changes to the legislation, including the changes to the constitution. The whole idea of those working groups is that although, again, technically and legally speaking, national movement does not need anybody's votes for having this or that election passed. The idea was that we reach a consensus and the national movement obliges itself to vote for the laws that will be accepted in this multi-party process, during this multi-party process. So the rule set by at the NDI, with the support of NDI or with the facilitation of NDI before the local elections, was that consensus minus one kind of a rule. So if everybody agrees and there is one party which is against, it's considered done and passed. Unfortunately, it did not work like that. And unfortunately, at the last moment, National Movement requested a vote, and obviously they were in majority, and they've got the votes, and then they passed the legislation as they decided to do. So what will happen this time, difficult to say. We have this experience, but we also have, I believe, and what I see now in Georgia, more involvement from the international community than it was before the local elections. There is more hope that the international community will be tougher with the government, with the ruling party, than it was before the local elections. I have a feeling that they care more how the national legislation for the elections will be for the 2012 elections, what will be state of media independence, what will be the police involvement than it was before. At least I'm trying to be optimistic. If it is the case, and if the international community will be clear enough in its messages and its attitude, then they don't have a choice. And obviously they will go for lots of positive developments. If they will see that it's just a matter of game and no one really cares, then we will have a majority vote again, and they always have a majority, and they will pass whatever laws they decide to pass. But again, it's very important to understand that it's not about the not only about the electoral law itself, what will be written in the Georgian electoral code. Georgian electoral code is more or less okay even now. It's about the environment, electoral environment, which is in a country. It's about no single national state media being independent. It's about no single national state media. We know who owes, we know who is behind, who is controlling. It's all monopolized by the government. It's all run actually by the government. and all the small TV stations, like one in Batumi. For those of you who knows Georgia, more or less, it's Channel 25, and two small stations in Tbilisi and one in Gori Triality. They are constantly under the pressure. They are constantly under this threat. Just last month, Triality's, the Gori-based independent TV channel's premises were invaded again, and their founder was arrested and beaten up by the police severely, and there were lots of reports by the human rights groups about the physical damage he came back from the police station with. So if it is not, if it won't change, then whatever we write in our electoral code does not really matter that much. Two, if the local activists are going to be under this threat all the time by the police, if the police involvement, police will be actually the one holding, dealing, conducting elections in regions of Georgia. Again, it does not really matter what is written in the code. I always say that when someone asks me how the local elections went in May, I always say that it was the Soviet Union. It was the Soviet Union because, yes, people did vote for the national movement, but there was no free vote, as well as in the Soviet Union. People were going and voting for the Communist Party, regardless of the fact they wanted to vote or not. It was exactly the same situation. We had groups of the people standing outside the polling stations, monitoring everybody who was going, who was going out. There were people who were told very clearly, directly, that they don't show up at the polling stations because they knew that these were opposition voters or they will have problems. So every time those voters were coming to the polling stations, there were like 10 ladies standing outside the station telling them, to, oh, by the way, we made a mark that you came, and we, of course, know that you are going to vote for the opposition. Do you remember your son who is using drugs, or do you remember your uncle who is working for this hospital, or your whomever working for the government, and so on and so forth? So if this continues and if it stays like that, and if the people will say that, okay, there were people outside the polling stations, but we did not see the violation, well, fine, then it's going to be the Soviet Union again in 2012 and all the time. But if there will be more attention to the general conditions, general environment, electoral environment in a country, plus necessary changes to the electoral code, a little bit of independence of the judiciary, then we might get something that is close to the elections. Today we do elections, but this is more like we did in the Soviet Union rather than in Judean democracies.
Thanks, Nadine. I wonder, Sam, if you'd like to comment on the elections and the parallels with the Soviet Union.
Well, sure. Just quickly with the on the election code, a point that my my friend and predecessor Jeff Goldstein recently made is that the main thing is that the code is issued and agreed to and clear well in advance of the elections. And that was a problem in the preceding elections, is that the election code, which I think Tina agrees is, you know, largely fair, was just unclear and not promulgated in enough time for all the parties to properly understand and use it. So I think in terms of the working group that you're taking part in now, hopefully there'll be a conclusion, you know, well in advance of the upcoming
We still have 2 years to go.
Yeah. So there's time for that. In terms of, you know, I think, you know, comparisons to the Soviet Union are a little bit extreme. I mean, in the Soviet times, there was no alternative, whereas, you know, you are an alternative, and there are other alternatives. And, you know, some of those alternatives are sitting in Parliament. Some of them are in City Hall. So I think that, you know, the comparing recent elections to the Soviet times is a little bit of hyperbole, but
but in terms of the mood, in terms of the attitude from the people's side of those people who would never vote for the national movement but were forced to vote for the national movement, that was exactly the feeling you were getting, that okay, that's how we voted 30 years ago, 40 years ago. We would go there just because we were afraid that relatives would be kicked out from the Communist Party, depriving all the future and possibilities in life. And that's what we did now again. That, yes, there is an alternative, but it really does not matter if you don't count the vote, if there is no free will to be.
What
expressed.
Matters, as a Georgian said, is not who, you know, what the votes are, but who counts the votes.
Right. Yeah. Stalin said it, actually.
Yeah.
Other questions? Yes, please, in the back and then here. If you could stand up, I think it might help to hear you a little better.
My name is Elise. I'm a graduate student at Catholic University. I was wondering how the psychosocial needs are being assessed and addressed of the IDPs and how community building is happening within the IDP camps.
Well, I can actually contributing with that regard because non-state actors are trying, as I mentioned, to provide not only typical legal assistance, for example, but also some psychosocial assistance because of a number of reasons, because of the war and hostilities, violence, as well as because of the social problems which displaced community face. The problems when it comes to their needs in this area is quite high, especially settlements provided to IDPs are, if we compare to the, say, so-called first wave of IDPs, IDPs displaced from the conflict zones beginning of 90s, and IDPs displaced just 2 years ago, of course, comparison is, well, difference is huge when it comes to the access to housing. However, still, now they started to have more access to other specific facilities like school, hospital, etc., but from the beginning it was just houses. More or less remote area, so it made some level of need in this direction quite high, and hopefully there were and there are still non-state, international as well as local non-government organizations providing such assistance. Well, one example can be given when it comes to domestic violence, for example. Unfortunately, problem of domestic violence is the problem in Georgia, and unfortunately, after war, various researches detected the high level of case of domestic violence among the IDP community in Gori or Shudakartli. So this is also an area where there's assistance and advice as well as some awareness-raising activity should be carried out. For the participation of local communities in decision-making process, it's again primarily non-state actor-driven, primarily driven by the international actors, international organizations, again Open Society Georgia Foundation, is being providing assistance to non-state actors to support IDPs being involved in the process of deciding assistance delivered to them, issues related to the governance of the government in exile, for example, for Abkhazia, etc. But still, more should be done at the local government level when it comes to the participation in the decision-making process. We had local elections, we have new local self-governing bodies, especially for the regions where IDPs are currently residing. However, still level of participation of citizens in local self-governance is quite low. So it's cross-sectoral problem. It's a problem which is faced by IDP as well as by non-IDP citizens of Georgia.
Nadine, did you want to add?
Sure, maybe just to add in one more example from our work in Georgia. We noticed that there is a need for psychosocial support, both with IDPs displaced in 1990s and in 2008, but the needs are very different. For those displaced in 2008, we focused mainly on children with after-school programs and children who first came having nightmares and so on as a result of their experiences during the conflict have slowly become normal children. Of course, the process isn't finished, but this is just one activity that we're doing as just one NGO in addition to others that are working on psychosocial assistance. In terms of community mobilization, this is something else that we're doing as well surrounding housing, mostly having to do with the privatization of collective centers that is ongoing. But what we're finding is that there's a lot of lack of information, or the information flows aren't flowing adequately to IDPs. So they have a lack of information which inhibits their participation. So that's one thing that we're trying to address as well.
Okay.
Briefly, and then we've got several hearings.
Yeah, just about the social assistance. Mm-hmm. One of the important issues here is, one thing is IDPs who are displaced, but the other is the people who their IDPs, but got back to the buffer zone villages. And this is the group of the people who are kind of, well, I wouldn't say completely forgotten, but somehow get less attention or sometimes no attention because it's considered that they are back to their villages and they can survive. But in reality, what we've heard here is exactly the problem for them as well, because most of those villages have lost their land, although they still have their gardens and the places where they had houses, which are burnt in most of the cases now, but they don't have land anymore. Most of the land and the forest, which is also a very important, stayed on the other side of the administrative border, so-called administrative border. So now these are the people who need most of the attention because there is no food, there is no wood for winter to not to freeze in their houses, and they seriously have huge problems. The same is, for example, with the water supply. The dam is on the other side of the administrative border, which is closed for them, and for the entire summer they had no drop of water there. So we have several problems of this kind. It's not just the IDPs who live in Tbilisi or in other cities, but even bigger problem is for those living in buffer zone. And I cannot miss this opportunity. Thank you, NRC, Danish Refugee Council as well, and all the refugee organizations who are actually doing a great job, because they, everywhere you travel, you see them. It's like you cannot miss them. They are everywhere. If there is any social assistance provided, it's by the either Norwegian Refugee Council or Danish Refugee Council, UNHCR or other groups working on IDPs and refugees, and they've been really doing a great job.
Is it okay with the panelists if we take three or four questions, sure, and then give you a chance? It's here? Do you have your hand?
My name is Anne Charlotte Nielsen. I'm writing about a book about children in non-conflict. So you kind of answered my questions, but I'm going to ask you more specific questions afterwards. because I'm interested in like the access to education and other issues.
Okay. Next question right here.
It was also.
And then one in the back, yes.
Thanks. Bacho Nadirat, I'm Georgetown University. Lately, we've been seeing protests in the capital of Georgia, mainly by IDPs, protesting the decision of Georgian government to send them to different like cities or villages outside of capital. I'm wondering what's your take on that. Is it too early to do this? I'm specifically interested on the take of Republican Party. Thanks.
Thank you. And there's one in the back here.
Yes. Hello. I'm Tom DeVal here at Carnegie. And I apologize. I arrived a bit late for the meeting. And I was just in Georgia last week, and I was struck by how Abkhazia and South Ossetia seem to have receded from the political discussion. All the talk was all about the economy and jobs, in particular high unemployment. And, of course, so I was interested in your perception about whether the government was doing anything in providing jobs and employment for IDPs, given that this there's also a kind of political temptation to keep them as kind of suffering people in camps without integrating them into the economy, whether there are any employment programs for them. And also, if you wouldn't mind, a brief comment on the situation in Akhal Gori. I gathered from conversations in Tbilisi, I didn't actually go up there, that the people there are finding it difficult to get access from either side, both in deeper into South Ossetia and into Georgia proper. Thank you.
Why don't we take one more here, and then we'll give a panelist a chance to respond.
Thanks. Mark Hetfield from the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. While a lot of you have talked about the importance of foreign affairs in Georgia and of the international community, there's only been one mention, I believe, Tina's mention of the UNHCR, of any of the UN in general, or of any UN organizations. So I was wondering, what role has the UN been playing in Georgia in terms of finding a solution to the conflict? What role should they be playing? And how is the UN perceived in Georgia?
Okay, a variety of questions there. Who'd like to jump in?
Well, let me say some, respond to some of the questions, not all of them, of course. First of all, education is really important. I wanted to follow on that. Access to education for youth, not only secondary education, but also higher education. It's not only an issue of distance. It's also an issue of possibility, access to tools, various tools like textbooks, possibility for funding within the country or outside the country for the continuous education. And unfortunately, although foreign aid coming to Georgia was, and I'm speaking about that based on this experience of the NGO monitoring of the foreign aid coming to Georgia, although this aid was directly related, targeted towards IDPs, I can't recall huge portfolio devoted towards education or some more or less sustainable, let's say, activities to support IDP communities. Well, some might argue whether there was a possibility of such to build good houses, provide some immediate social assistance, even some food, and at the same time provide long-term perspectives for the education as well as some. But I believe that this should be a priority. We believe that it should be a priority which should be somehow championed by the government. Because nowadays, I will not repeat the names of these organizations. I fully support what Tinati mentioned. Nowadays, all these services and the possibilities are provided by non-state actors, especially by the international organizations. Issue related to the UN, I would like to mention, first of all, role of the UN Secretary General Special Representative on Internal Displacement, Dr. Walter Kylan's involvement to Georgia. His involvement is, and this involvement of this body is really important because the mechanism, well, he personally traveled to Georgia after war a number of times, and because of the policy, pushing policy discussion, legislative changes, as well as practical changes for the sake of the IDPs. So I'm answering from this perspective of the IDPs, their rights and the possibilities. And I guess for Ahal Goli, I would like to mention that unfortunately, when there are still cases of continuous human rights violations, on which some non-state actors are trying to respond from human rights perspective, providing legal aid to citizens, unfortunately there are some issues related to the access to Ahal Goli. And here I believe Tinatin knows better than I know this reality and can continue from this point.
Okay, Ahal Goli, we can speak about different problems there. Access, I would not say it's a primary concern, because if your ID is issued in Ahal Goli, then it's not a big deal. Yes, you need to go through the checkpoints, through the security, but I think it's normal when you are in a nearly war situation there. Access is not such a big problem. It is a problem for us. For example, if Georgi and myself will decide to travel to Ahal Goli, yes, we will have limited possibility for that, and we would need all kinds of permissions from all sides. But as for the people who are from Ahal Goli, I don't see it as a major problem. And I know many people, as Georgi mentioned, I work with the people from Ahal Goli a lot. I have, as a lawyer, well, I mean, I have this both caps all the time, a politician and a lawyer from my human rights work, from which people know me mostly. I have around 1,500 inhabitants of Ahal Goli whom I am representing right now in courts on different proceedings, because they are the ones who suffer the most in terms of housing, compensation, and getting various social packages available for IDPs. And that's the problem, real problem we are seeing. People from Ahal Goli are told number of things by the government. One, that their houses have not been burned, they are still there, they can go back and live in their houses. Two, that because they travel back and forth, government tells them that, well, you can still grow your crops in your gardens, bring them to Georgia, sell them, so you are not really the one in most need, as, let's say, people from Tamarasheni or Achabeti or other villages where the houses were entirely burned. I said a couple of times in several interviews that what I observe today, attitude is similar to Gali towards Ahal Goli. Government is trying to make Ahal Goli something like Gali. Gali, for those who does not know, is the southern part of Abkhazia, which is mainly populated by Georgians, and is well, that's my understanding of GALI, that is used and manipulated all the time by both sides, Georgian government, Russian government, Abkhaz as well, for planning whatever games they are planning exactly around the GALI. It's something similar now happening with Akhalgori. So if there is a new provocation to happen from whatever side, Akhalgori will be the perfect case for it because Georgians still go there back and forth and they can always be manipulated. The same goes for Ossetians. Ossetians live there. They also go back and forth. So from the other side, they can be manipulated. And what I see there, it's something very close to GALI. Other problem people from Akhalgori have is that, and it is actually true, and it's very difficult to number and count and say exactly, most of them own houses in Georgia proper. And it is obviously a problem. Because, and here I fully agree with the government, that when it comes to the limited resources, we need to help the most, those who are most in need. Yes, I understand that those people also lost their lands and lost their houses, and although even if they travel in Akhalgori, it does not mean that tomorrow it will be the same and they can go and live there. But still, if they own a house in Tbilisi or anywhere else in Georgia, I don't think that they should be given the first priority in terms of giving houses or giving the compensation. So the list should be starting from those on top who lost everything and really live on the street and now they are in need of some roof on their top rather than those who have houses. But they don't really understand it. And they say that it's been 2 years. It's not like September 2008, but it's been 2 years. And how comes that our time never came? And there is some logic in it as well. But again, it's a big controversy there. And lots of people had summer houses in Akhalgori. And the villages that were close to now Georgia proper. At that time, Akhalgori was always under Georgian control, and people would go back and forth there. And lots of people who were from displaced from after the first war in South Ossetia actually bought houses in Akhalgori, and they were based in there. So now they have a problem. Because if they were registered as IDPs, and this is another problem with IDPs in Georgia, if they were registered as IDPs from the first war, although, even if they've lost now their secondary residence, Georgian government tries to manipulate with them and say that, oh, you are the IDPs from the first war? Your program did not start yet. Come in 2011. And it is a real problem, because many people who were displaced, let's say, from Tzhin Valley after the first war, they did not live in Tbilisi. They lived in villages that went under Georgian control. And, of course, they are on a secondary displacement right now. But they have a status from the first war. So because of that, they are treated differently than first-time IDPs. And they are like a specific group. As for the very short about the education, the only thing I can add to what Georgi was saying was that we had an initiative, Republican Party, to have books for schools, secondary schools and primary schools, provided for free for IDP children who were in need of it, as well as for the children in buffer zone, formerly buffer zone villages. Unfortunately, this proposal was not accepted by the government. And I think that it is very urgent and needed and necessary, because these people have problem with closing, not to talk about the books, which is pretty expensive if you take it seriously and if you really want to have a normal education and have the books and everything. As for...
I have questions about employment and the protests by IDP.
IDP protest, yeah. About the IDP process, here we need to differentiate because it's not the similar and same for everybody. We had IDPs who were, during the whole summer, and again, for those who does not know, IDPs were expelled from their temporary housings, sent to the villages in western Georgia, close to Abkhazia, and some of them given the compensation. What was the standing of the Republican Party? I was personally involved in this case heavily. Because we've got this expelling of the new IDPs as well. And I strongly believe that every year where new IDPs have been expelled and sent to the villages nearby Abkhazia doesn't make sense. Because this is not a natural environment for them. These are the people from South Ossetia. totally different, totally different would be too much, but kind of a different mentality, different attitudes, different language they speak, actually, because, you know, in Samegrelo, it's quite difficult for them for people from the Shida Kartli to live. Yes, we've joined their protest of this particular group, and we've said it's not fair, it's not right, and if there is any reason for privatization reasons or whatever reasons that this building needs to be emptied, they should be given another housing, either in Tbilisi or Gori or somewhere close to their natural environment, rather than sending them on the totally other side of the country. Second group was IDPs from war in Abkhazia, from 90s. So, and here, again, we need to differentiate. I have right now a case in a court where I'm a lawyer of two groups, around 70 people, who moved to Tbilisi 17 years ago and lived in these very places for 17 years. There are children who were born in Tbilisi who have nothing to do with Abkhazia other than meets their parents are telling them how nice beaches in Abkhazia and how much they want to go there. All their social environment is Tbilisi. They live in Tbilisi, they go to school, they went to school in Tbilisi, friends, everybody they have in Tbilisi. I strongly believe that sending them to the villages in Western Georgia is a forceful displacement by your own government. Because this displacement is not... moving of the people against their will is no different from what happened during the war. The only difference is that they are not shot. But other than that, it's against their will, and it's against the social environment they've grown up and they are used to. And now they are told that you should start a totally new life. But we have groups of the people who took an advantage, to say very clearly, of the August War. And after these hotels and kindergartens and different places, we are that were emptied after the August War, return in October, November 2008. There were groups of people who took an advantage and occupied those buildings, emptied by new IDPs. And these were mainly people who came in August 2008 to Tbilisi from the regions. So when they were forced to leave, when they were first asked and then forced to leave, well, I still have a problem with the forms government took against them, like 2,000 policemen surrounding the building in the middle of the night, throwing out their belongings, putting them forcefully in cars and sending to the villages. Yes, I have a problem with that. But legally speaking, just in terms of the relocation, I think government was right. But again, it was about the forms that the government used against them. So we basically talk about three different groups that were affected in summer 2010. And I would have problems with all of them, but of a different different way.
UN.
Well, UN, there is not much I can say about UN. I can say much more about the Council of Europe, European Union's involvement, not that much about the UN. UN in Georgia was working more on development in a very traditional understanding of it rather than IDPs or, I don't know, any particular group. They would finance lots of governmental programs oriented on development. UNHCR was always very active. Georgi and myself, we were with the Young Lawyers Association. We used to work in a very big project dealing with reconciliation in South Ossetia at that time, in 96, 97, 98. We would travel to Tsxinvali very often, and that was all UNHCR-driven projects that we were providing roof supplies for the houses in Ossetian villages, and that was a very funny project for Georgians, but actually very useful of livestock given... female livestock, I don't know what's the English word for it, but female livestock given to a Georgian village and male livestock to the Ossetian village, so they would feel needed in cooperation. So lots of different things like that. But it was all done by UNHCR, not by the UNDP per se, but by the UNHCR office in Tbilisi. And they were always very helpful. I don't really know about that much what they've done after the August War, because initiative was mainly taken by the Council of Europe and organizations like DRC and NRC, they were much more active, maybe getting money from UN, I don't know, but they were more active rather than UNHCR itself.
UNHCR was active quite. During August War, actually, excuse me for interruption, but during August War, UNHCR played a really important role, in, especially when it comes to Abkhazia and Kodori, so-called Upper Abkhazia, Kodori, gorge of evacuating IDPs as well as afterwards assistance. So UNHCR still continue to be active, to be honest, at the field, together with the non-state organizations.
If I could just say two things quickly. In terms of the IDPs and their role in the political context, you know, the August War created 130,000 more IDPs, compounding the problem from the 1990s war. This is a significant constituency, and it's a constituency that needs to be spoken to about real issues. So jobs are such issues, jobs, housing. There's a need for an interim solution. The war put back the chances for reintegration. And so I think, you know, not only the government, but opposition parties and society in general needs to be realistic in managing the expectations and looking at an interim solution in the hopes that there'll be a more permanent solution later. And that should be part of the political dialogue. And in terms of the question about the UN, I think it's equally important to look at what the OSCE is doing. And, you know, in this year of the Kazakh chairmanship, I think there have been a couple trips to Georgia. Whether or not there's a political declaration at the Astana summit next the week after next will be important. I think it'll be important for the Georgians. It'll be important for the Russians. And I think that's something to look forward to.
Okay, why don't we take just two quick questions, if we can have quick questions. Maybe one over here. Okay, about this woman right here.
Yeah. Jane Kittage from Carnegie Endowment. I guess I would like to direct this question particularly at two Georgian participants. And clearly the war was Russia stirred a lot of anti-Russian sentiments, both on a popular level as well as when it comes to political rhetoric, when Russia is frequently described in sort of black terms. So I was wondering whether you foresee some sort of the renewal of the dialogue, the rapprochement between Georgia and Russia, if not on a political level, then on, I guess, people-to-people, second-track level. And I'm asking this question particularly because I believe today there is a delegation of Georgian youth visiting Moscow. So I wonder whether you can interpret it as, you know, one-of-a-kind incident or something that would have a follow-up in the future.
Okay. Well, yes, there is lots of anti-Russian attitude, but I would not say it's in within, among the people.
No.
It's more politicized. It's on the surface. If you go talk to the average Georgian, there is no any anti attitude, anti-Russian or anti-anyone, anti-Ossetian, anti-Abkhazian, you almost never found it. That's something we can really be proud of as Georgians. But if you come to Georgia for like a week, 2 days, 3 weeks, you watch TV, you meet with the politicians or NGOs or whatever social political elite representatives, you will hear lots of anti-Russian, which is not, again, fortunately reflected that much in the majority of the people. Actually, I can say even more, first time for these 20 years, there was a pro-Russian vote in Georgia in May 2010. There was no single political party in Georgia for 20 years who would advocate anything pro-Russian. It was very unpopular. It was a political suicide. And that's Misha's achievement, that we've got a pro-Russian political force in Georgia. It's one of the novelties Saakashvili brought to Georgia, that it's okay to be pro-Russian now. And there was a quite significant support this group got, which was very unexpected for me personally. I was not expecting such a high support in Tbilisi, for example, for them. People-to-people dialogue, I don't know. I'm a very strong believer, and I belong to a political party which is very strong believer of the dialogue on any level, because we believe that it's always better than taking guns and going into the war. And we've been advocating for Georgian Abkhaz, Georgian Ossetian, Georgian Russian dialogue all the time. But my fear is here that Well, we did not mention this state strategy about the IDPs and conflict resolution, which was adopted a year ago, I guess, by the government. But they are everything you have there, and the main problem which you have there, and we Georgians, Georgian opposition, have with this program and strategy, is that it's so much about Georgia-Russia, whether it's in terms of dialogue or whether it's in terms of confrontation, that the real issue, which is Georgian Abkhaz, Georgian Ossetian problem, is forgotten. It's getting on the second, behind the scenes. And it's the Georgian-Russian conflict overshadowed the real problems. And I am afraid that once again, Georgian government will make the same mistake that was happening there for the last 17 years. The rhetorics that we have no problem with Abkhaz, we have no problem with Ossetians, we can perfectly live with them, and it's only Russia which is complicating the situation. Although I do agree, I have no problem saying, like some of the Georgian politicians, that there was an occupation, that Russian army is illegally standing in Georgia. Yes, Russia interfered. Yes, there was an ethnic cleansing conducted by the Russians. But still, there is a very deeply rooted problem between Georgians and Abkhaz, Georgians and Ossetians. And as long as we ignore it, as long as we just talk about Georgia-Russian politics, Georgian-Russian confrontation, Georgian-Russian war, we are going to be going around the same circle we are going for these 17 years. Because what Georgia needs to address, what the primary concern of the Georgian government should be, as I understand it, is addressing the security threats Abkhaz have, very legitimate ones. Ossetians have, very legitimate ones. We should be constantly thinking about them, about their problems, about the security issues that are there in Sukhumi and Tskhinvali, and trying to convince these people that there is no threat from Georgia, that it's about democratic, prosperous, going to European Union Georgia, which is so much better choice than Russia with Chechnya and Russia in Beslan and Russia in August 2008. As long as we don't achieve this goal, I don't see any chance and potential for reintegration, as Georgian government says it, but I would rather say living in a common state. Because there are, again, very legitimate concerns there in both capitals, Tskhinvali and Sukhumi, and we need to be constantly addressing them. And the last point here is about the IDP conditions in Georgia, because the way we treat IDPs, the way Georgian government treats the IDPs, is the best example for Abkhaz and South Ossetians, whether they should trust Georgian government or not. When an average Abkhaz mother of my age with two kids, as I have, lives on the other side of the administrative border, looks in Zugdidi and sees how Georgians from Abkhazia are treated by its own government, what kind of conditions they live in, what kind of threats go through, what kind of pressure they go through, I don't think that they want to ever consider reunification or reintegration with Georgia. But as long as we are a real, true democracy, treating equally with respect our own citizens, then there are more guarantees for minorities, for other nations, that they will be treated the same way. But unfortunately, today's Georgia is not the one that will be your first choice if there is a choice given to you which way to go, Tbilisi or Moscow. I don't see it in Moscow either, but I think that with all the developments for these last years, we just pushed Abkhaz more closer to Moscow than to Tbilisi. And it's our mistake, and we need to recognize those mistakes and work on them rather than just saying that, always pointing on Moscow and saying that, oh yeah, there is this bad guy over there and there is nothing I can do. There is a lot we can do, actually, for solving these problems, if you want. And just small clarification about the numbers. You said 133,000. It's actually an initial number. Today we talk about 27,000 IDPs, new IDPs, because the rest was back in the buffer zone villages. So it's not as bad as it looks. And official data says that only 7,000 have been have been given full social protection as it is prescribed by the Georgian law, whether it's compensation or housing. Out of 27,000, it's only 7,000. I have an official communication from the ministry where they say that, and they say that they don't have more money, which is not true. But that's another topic for another talk.
Thanks. I think there are a lot of topics for further talks, but we're going to have to close now. Thanks to all four of our panelists and to all of you.